Les conférences du Collège de France.
I'm going to start because I have 100 slides and I'm probably not going to get through all of them anyway. But anyway, thank you all for coming. This is my third lecture at the Collège de France. I'm very grateful for its hospitality. I'm going to talk today about the market for ideas, but which is a concept that's been around. I'm not the first to have come up with it. Some famous economists like Ronald Coase and George Stigler have already written about it. I'm going to take a more historical point of view, as you will see. So the structure of the talk is really quite straightforward. This is economics, so there will be a supply, mostly supply, a little bit about demand, and then I want to talk about the market itself, because markets themselves require a technology to operate, and I want to talk about that a little bit. And then, hopefully, there's enough time to talk about the market for ideas today, although most of this will be about history. But before I do that, I want to ask the question, is the market for ideas really a useful concept? Sorry, the heading is wrong. And how should we think about the marketplace for ideas? And, you know, in some ways, of course, the word market, which economists have obviously put in the center of the whole discipline, and this isn't really a market if you were a stricto sensu, because what we know is that knowledge may be a product, or ideas are a product, but there's no real market clearing price in that market, okay? So it's hard to say that this market is in equilibrium in any sense. You know, economists like the concept of equilibrium, but in this market, I'm not totally sure it's a terribly helpful concept. It is, however, true that knowledge is valuable and that it is in some definable sense in short supply. So it is a good, or a service if you want, but of course it isn't a good like other goods. It is a public good. In fact, I would think of it as sort of the mother of all public goods, okay? This is a market that is extremely prone to what economists call market failures, and I will talk about that a little bit. But we talk about other things that are markets. We talk about the marriage market. This was also popularized by a University of Chicago economist, Gary Becker. Is it a market? Well, there too you may wonder to what extent the concept of equilibrium is a useful concept, but there we go. So here are the main issues about the marketplace for ideas that people have been writing about. And I was just, as it happened last night, Professor Eva Illouz, who's here, brought this book to my attention. This book came just out a few months ago. And thanks to the miracles of the internet, I was able to read a long chapter called The Marketplace for Ideas. And essentially, it's a discussion of what I want to talk about, but from a very different point of view. So people wonder, you know, whether to what extent free competition in the marketplace for ideas or tended to produce the correct outcome or the truth, and whether bad ideas are eventually defeated by good ideas, and that therefore, presumably, free speech should be allowed always, as this book, of course, proposes and then criticizes quite severely. And, you know, in the skeptical attitude that Farah is taking here is, in fact, you know, in some ways justified, but it's not what I'm going to talk about. I'm not going to take a position on what is true and what is not. Much less am I going to say a great deal about things like political power, social hierarchy, dominant discourses, and other things that historians and sociologists like to talk about. My interest as an economist is in economic growth, and economic growth driven by new ideas, basically since the late Middle Ages. And my interest is in markets. And as I said, this is a fascinating but somewhat weird market. Now, to be sure, markets and institutions, as we learned from my great friend and former Nobel Prize winner, Douglas North, markets require institutions. Basically, they are the rules of the game, and I would add the technology that makes the game possible, that determine incentives and behavior and eventually make markets work. And this is, of course, a fortiori true for the market for ideas, but the rules in the market for ideas, because there is no price and there is no money changing hands, are, of course, a little bit different, so you'd have to kind of get out of the sort of mindset of what economists think about markets and put yourself into something a little bit more, maybe metaphorical. So here's an obvious question. In the market for ideas, what is the nature of a transaction? We know what transactions look like in a regular market, right? I give you money and you give me a pair of shoes and we've had a transaction. But that's not the way it works here. So the way I'm proposing here, that in the market for ideas, the way it works is an agent has an idea, hopefully a new idea, and he tries to persuade people. He tries to persuade potential buyers to accept his idea. And, you know, if she or he succeeds, you've made a sale. You may also sell a book, but that's really secondary. The main thing is that you want to convince somebody, right? So some famous cases of major successes in the market for ideas are, of course, very famous. In economics, you know, you would point perhaps to the Wealth of Nations as being, you know, an ultimate success in selling an idea, but the same would be true, I mean, perhaps even more so, of Marx's Capital, John Maynard Keynes' General Theory, and, you know, on and on and on and on. So these were obviously people who were extremely successful in the market for ideas, and for every person who's very successful in the market for ideas, there are 100 obscure economists who also try to convince people and didn't succeed. Okay, that's just the way this market works. And in the 16th century, which is where I really want to begin, basically, how do you propose ideas in the market for ideas? Well, it's, you know, by that time, the printing press, of course, had been invented, and people were printing books. There was also a correspondence network, known sometimes as the Republic of Letters, and I may come back to that. But, you know, one way of convincing people, and in at least one case, a very successful way, was to nail 95 propositions to the church door at Wittenberg, right? And that, too, was a successful attempt to sell ideas by the person who wrote it. And I'm submitting to you that despite the many changes in technology, and particularly, of course, communications and knowledge towards technology, basically, that's what we still have today. We people try to sell ideas. And the real question I want to know is why. But I would say that the market for ideas and modern economic growth is in large part driven by changes in the market for ideas in early modern Europe. And of that knowledge, of course, there is what I call useful knowledge, which is essentially what we would call today science and technology, which eventually, of course, leads to higher productivity, new products, and a higher living standard. There are also things, I don't want to call them useless ideas, because that's, you know, that's denigrating, but there are things like theology and philosophy and studying the classics, which are, I call them, other knowledge. But there, too, of course, people want to sell an idea. But I'm going to focus on knowledge, on useful knowledge, for the simple reason that I'm interested in economic growth, as I said. So as I said, too, this is a market prone to a variety of market failures. And you know, in economics, we have a well-defined theory of what market failures are about and what they do. And perhaps the sort of classic examples of what a public good, which is essentially a form of market failure, is first, that it is non-rivalrous. Knowledge is non-rivalrous in the sort of trivial sense that if I have some and I give it to you, I don't have any less myself, unlike pizza or what, and almost any other good that you can think. Secondly, it is very costly and difficult to exclude people, okay? So if I buy an apartment, I have the right to exclude you from entering your apartment because it is sort of my apartment. But if I have knowledge, can I actually keep people out without paying me? And the answer is yes, I can, or I can do this if I keep it secret. But it's very difficult to keep most ideas secret, and in fact, it's very much against the spirit of the times. And so, but the thing about exclusion is that if I tell just one person, then I lose control, because that person can spread the knowledge on. And so, in that sense, too, you can say this is a non-excludable good, and therefore a public good, in that sense. Moreover, if we talk about market failures, of course, we talk about externalities, and knowledge has major externalities. There's sort of two kinds of externalities, the way it seems to me. There's sort of vertical externalities, in the sense that if I come up with an idea, somebody else then can build on my idea, right? So in mathematics, you know, I prove a theorem, and then somebody else proves another theorem that relies on my theorem, and the same is true in almost any field that you can think of, okay? So even Newton famously said that, you know, he had, could see further because he had been able to stand on the shoulders of giants, and clearly this is sort of an obvious thing. Science is cumulative. There's also horizontal externalities, particularly, I think, in technology and science, in which knowledge in one field is used in another field and makes it possible to make progress. And finally, of course, there is a lot of uncertainty. When you get somebody proposes new knowledge, how do we know that the new knowledge is correct? And how do we know it's really new? And most important, how can you tell the wheat from the chaff? So what knowledge is relevant and what knowledge is just noise? And when is information disinformation? And how can you recognize charlatans, fakes, and quacks? To make things more complicated even, since we're looking at a market, the question is, how competitive is this market? And in history, we have had cases in which there have been major monopolies in the market for ideas, in which some entity was able to exclude others and basically completely control what kind of knowledge could be created and what kind of knowledge could not be created. So the three examples that I have here that will sort of drive this home is first, of course, the medieval church, in which if you came up with an idea that the church didn't like, then you could be considered a heretic and get yourself into trouble. Ask Jan Hus, who was burned at the stake in 1415 for being a heretic. A very different but equally monopolistic thing is the Chinese Imperial Examination, or the so-called famous Keijiu Examination, in which essentially anybody who got an education aimed at entering the Chinese Imperial service had to study a very well-defined set of literature, most of it Neo-Confucian philosophy, going back to Zhu Xi and his students, and basically that's what everybody studied. The Chinese academies barely ever taught the kind of things that we teach in the West, medicine, mathematics, astronomy, physics, and so on and so forth. Certainly, it got worse over time. And finally, I'm reminding people that even in modern times, there are cases, maybe not full monopoly, but certainly very limited competition. If you think about Lyshenkoism in the Soviet Union, Lyshenko was this famous biologist charlatan that Stalin liked and basically made him the head of the entire Russian scientific pyramid, with devastating results for Russian science because he was truly a charlatan. And so, one more thing maybe. Resistance. New ideas, and this I find it difficult to find close equivalents for that in other markets, but maybe there are. But there is always resistance to intellectual change. Sometimes this is resistance comes from well-defined entities that are threatened by it. Think of the resistance to, say, Martin Luther and John Calvin by the Catholic Church in the 16th century. But in science, too, there is resistance. There was major resistance, for instance, to this discovery of the germ theory of disease in the last third of the 19th century by Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch. And, you know, there are many, you know, there are, and those of you may know what I mean, but this is many Max Pettenkofer. So Max Pettenkofer was this German doctor, a very distinguished doctor, who basically decided that this germ theory was wrong, and he famously drank this glass of cholera-contaminated water, and then he didn't die, which proved that the germ theory was wrong. So, I mean, that happens quite a lot. Even Albert Einstein himself, as I'm sure many of you know, he helped found quantum mechanics, but then famously rejected the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics and the idea of fundamental indeterminacy in physics. In technology, too, a famous example is James Watt himself, who built a steam engine that was based on what we call low-pressure principles, but there was an alternative called high-pressure principle, which is a somewhat different design, and it had major advantages, but Watt decided that this was evil, and he fought it tooth and nail until the year 1800, and then his patent ran out, so that was the end of that. But there was resistance to innovation throughout. And so here is an issue that an economist would ask from history, and that's what I basically do, ladies and gentlemen. What kind of incentives are there if there is no appropriability? So if I cannot own the knowledge by selling it to you, by saying, well, I'll tell you, but only if you pay me so and so much, what's incentivizing me? You know, people presumably want to make a living, and how do we do this? And that, I think, that kind of incentive is central to the story of how the supply side of the market for ideas works. And so I want to say something about the emergence of the modern market for ideas, because, you know, it's something that's actually quite fascinating. My sense is that in its current form, you know, more or less, it emerged in Europe in the late Middle Ages and in the Renaissance. And that this, as the church was weakening, particularly in the 15th century, and as other things happened, which I'll talk about in a minute, this became a an increasingly competitive and centralized markets in which people wrote books, particularly, of course, after they could print them, trying to convince others of their insights. So what characteristics does this market have? Well, the first is open science. So what open science means, and we all practice open science, it basically means that if you have an idea, never mind if it's a mathematical theorem or, you know, you discovered some new element or whatnot, you have an idea, you put it in the public realm. You publish it. So we have institutionalized that by our publish or perish rules. But even people who have sort of made it to the highest levels of success in academia still keep publishing, because we all believe in open science in principle. Unless there's some very good reason why you don't want to publish it, but then typically, that means you want to keep out the competition. You want to be the first to publish it. So you keep it secret until you publish it. Once you publish it, it's open. Essentially, that's the way it works. Secondly, we formalized, at least in the West, the notion of priority rights. So I don't own the knowledge, but it is associated with me, so I get the credit, but not the profit. And so everybody knows, for instance, that Nicolaus Copernicus wrote the Revolutionibus, published it in 1546, and that he was the guy who for the first time came up with the notion that the sun was in the center of the solar system and planets circulated around it. But anyway, that's not entirely true. There were others who had suggested similar things, but he is the guy who's widely regarded to be that person. And so everybody knows the name of Copernicus, and of course the same is true for Newton and for Galileo, and, you know, on and on and on and on. The other thing is, and this is something that I talked about already, but it's something that I really think is important, is this market for ideas essentially abandoned intellectual ancestor worship, in the sense, and this is, I think, fully incorporated in this. This is the slogan of the London Royal Society, founded in 1660, and the slogan says, in nullius verba, mean don't take anybody's word for it. So the sort of medieval notion that Aristotle and Galenus and a few others were authorities who knew everything, and if you want to know something, you just look it up in Aristotle, you get the answer. This is abandoned in this market, okay? And therefore, everything is contestable, including, by the way, the great heroes of the period, including Newton himself. So everything is challenged, everything is continuously treated with skepticism, and that's, I think, a healthy thing. Now, what this institution does, and this is, of course, what I'm talking about here, is what is now known as the Respublica Literaria, or the Republic of Letters, is it assessed and evaluated ideas, and it provided what people craved more than anything else, and I'll talk about that in a minute, reputation. It is also transnational, in the sense that national borders didn't matter, language didn't matter, because at least for a while everybody was writing in Latin, and then eventually people were starting to write in the vernacular, but things that were important were translated. And finally, and this is more controversial, it was at least to some extent egalitarian and meritocratic. And I say here there are a few barriers to entry, but that's, of course, subject to the fact that if you didn't know Latin, you couldn't play this game. And if you were illiterate, you know, you were, which is what the vast bulk of population was, clearly you didn't. But apart from that, it is true that many of the great successful scientists, not all, but many of them, came from sort of what we would call today, roughly speaking, the upper middle class, or, you know, people who have, whose family had enough money to educate them and send them to college, but not necessarily people who were wealthy. So, you know, if you look at England, for instance, you look at Robert Hooke, you look at Newton, you look at France, you look at Descartes, Spinoza. I mean, these people were leading intellectuals who didn't come from the peasantry, but they were certainly not aristocrats. There were a few aristocrats who played this game as well, of course. And so between 1500 and 1750, you get a stream of new ideas. So for instance, you look at religion, right? So it's not just Luther and Calvin, it's a whole bunch of other people, many of whom had a major influence on the thinking of future generations, meaning they were successful salespersons in the market for ideas. So you get Francis Bacon, Spinoza, Descartes, you know, all these people, and I haven't even started talking about Adam Smith. But outside that, in what I call useful knowledge, you have the same thing, you know? I mean, of those, you know, my favorite is this guy. This is a man called Paracelsus, the Swiss doctor. And basically, he was going to overthrow all of classical medicine as, you know, passed on via Galenus through Arab, mostly as Arab doctors in the Middle Ages. But, you know, Copernicus and Galileo, quite obviously. There's this guy, Stahl, who came up with a completely new chemistry, which turned out to be wrong, but that's beside the point, you know. And so I think of these people as sort of cultural entrepreneurs, and I have written some articles about that. But the one idea that became central and became victorious in the market for idea after maybe around 1650 or 1660, and with increasing power in the 18th century, is the idea of progress. And that I really do want to talk about. So the idea was, you know, I mean, I have given most of the credit of that idea to Francis Bacon. This seems to be a consensus in the literature. If you dig deep enough, of course, you will find other people who were there before him. But it's fair to say that until the work of Francis Bacon in the late 16th, early 17th century, the idea of progress was very rare and not ever really made expressed carefully. You could not find it in classical civilization. You do not find it in China. This is a new idea that is proposed by people like Bacon and eventually is extremely successful in the market for ideas with major economic consequences. Okay? So, you know, here is one typical example, a name that everybody in this room will recognize, Blaise Pascal. And so in the preface to his Pensée, this is, sorry, I left out that book, that title, but that's the name. He talks about the atmosphere. And the atmosphere had just been discovered a few years earlier by a man called Evangelista Torricelli, who was a student of Galileo's. And basically, Pascal was very enthusiastic about it, no kind of a description of how he runs up and down a mountain with a pyrometer in his hand, and he shows how the air pressure goes down. So it's a wonderful thing. And he then explains that what this really implies is that scientific progress will continue forever. And he basically thinks, so he says, what he says here is very nice. He says, humanity should be really thought of as a single person who lives forever and continually learns and continually accumulates knowledge. And so later generations inherit the knowledge of previous generations and add to it. And that, I think, becomes the sort of mantra of the time. And of course, what that does is it directly challenges the traditional authority of antiquity, and it generates what became known in France as the querelle des anciens et des modernes, the struggle between the ancients and the moderns, which basically is a debate which looks rather silly today, I must say. You know, who are better? So people like Aristophanes or Molière, or, you know, Galenus or Sydenham. You know, I mean, it's a bit childish, but what it really indicates is that people have come to realize that they knew more than classical antiquity, and as they said, future generations will know even more than they did, which of course is totally clear. So there is this debate, as I said, and by 1700, and this is a rough date, of course, this debate is over. The Republic of Letter and the sort of overall society became increasingly not so much about whether we can make society better, but how. And the idea of progress, I think, becomes an organizing concept in the Enlightenment of the 18th century. Not everybody, of course, subscribed to it. The Enlightenment is a big tent, and people disagreed about everything. And of course, you have people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was very ambiguous about progress, but I would say he's probably more of an exception than the rule. So here is just one more example, just for the hell of it. This is Charles Perrault, another Frenchman, famous for codifying these ancient legends. But basically, he makes the same kind of story. And of course, living when he lives, he says, oh, well, the age of Louis XIV, you know, has equaled or surpassed antiquity in every way. You know, it's not, you know, the age of King Charles in England or, you know, King William, or anything. It's the age of Louis XIV because he's French. But basically, that is, I think, the notion. And so, as I said, this becomes a fundamental belief in the market for ideas that is accepted by more and more people because, essentially, as I said, the moderns win the debate. And so then the question is, well, if it is true, ladies and gentlemen, that people were committed to the idea that useful knowledge, meaning essentially what we would call science and technology, are the things that will bring about progress, how do we get people, how do we incentivize people to engage in that? You know, so obviously progress is not made by the average person, it is made by people who are highly trained, highly original, thinking outside the box, have a lot of technical ability, and so on and so forth. Okay, so this is what I call upper tail human capital. Okay, so the people who are not just you know, that they speak Latin and that they can read, da, 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 but also that they think outside the box and have original ideas. But how do you incentivize that? And so what I'm going to propose to you is what I call the great bifurcation, that the incentives for useful knowledge are split into two. And to point this out, I want to make a distinction between what I call propositional knowledge, which is essentially science plus, okay? So it's science plus some other things, but it's a description. It's a description of what the world is about, you know, natural phenomena, natural laws, you know, all the way from, you know, Newton's laws of motion to the description of people like Linnaeus and, you know, on and on, botanists and biologists and so on and so forth. Prescriptive knowledge is what we would call today technology. It's not quite the same, but it's very close. So what I think of as prescriptive knowledge is essentially a recipe. So a recipe is a set of instructions. You know, how do you make a cake? That's a form of prescriptive knowledge. You know, well, you take two eggs and you take flour and sugar, blah, 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 you mix it, put it in the oven, and that's, you get a cake. Now, the same way of writing it down is also when you build a nuclear reactor, also, you know, the recipe will be longer and have lots of, you know, do loops and so on. But basically, it is, that's the kind of knowledge I'm talking about. And what I'm arguing, and this is an idea that's been around, but I think this is an application to this historical episode, is that prescriptive knowledge, let's say the technological knowledge, is normally rewarded through what we call in economics high-powered incentives. And what that really means is that there's a close correlation between the success of the idea and the rewards that you get. So if you invent something and it sells very well, you'll get rich. And if you invent something and it doesn't sell well, then you don't get rich. And that's what high-powered ideas are. Propositional knowledge is low power because we have people who made major advances to science. And, you know, and they, you know, they did okay by it, but there's no proportionality between the invention and the sort of social benefit, the discovery and the social benefit. And I'll come back to that, okay? So the big advance here is the invention of the patent system. Now, the patent system first appears, convenient to my kind of argument, in the late kind of fight, 15th century, in Italy, in Venice, I think we have patents in 1476. In England, the patent law is passed in 1624. And in other parts of the Western world, people talk about the patents, and it is quite interesting that both in North America and in France, one of the first things that they do is when the revolution occurs, essentially, you know, driven by Enlightenment ideas, one of the first things that they both do is institute a patent system. Now, the patent system is a typical European insight. I have never seen any evidence that the Islamic world came up with it, nor do we see any evidence for it in China until, of course, eventually, in China, they figured out that the West were doing this, and now they're patenting like mad. But that's the last 10 or 20 years. But certainly in imperial China, you see nothing of the sort. And so, of course, patents aren't the only way in which you incentivize inventors. And here's a whole list of them. So one thing you could do, and people tried, is to keep the technique secret and secure what I call TERs, which are temporary exclusionary rents, by the fact that you have a monopoly because nobody else knows how to do it. The most famous example of keeping a technique secret and preserving it for many years is Coca-Cola. So in Atlanta, there is a vault with 24 hours around-the-clock security in which the Coca-Cola company keeps the recipe for Coca-Cola. And nobody's been able to make it, to replicate it exactly. You can take a bottle of Coca-Cola and do what you want. You cannot reverse engineer it. Believe me, Pepsi tried. Then, of course, there's first mover's advantage. So if you invent something, and even if you don't patent it, and even if you don't keep it secret, but you have a few years in which you just know how to make it, and until other people catch up, Maybe you can make enough money to pay for your, for your research and development and even for your pension. But of course, society knew that neither of those work fully. So there are cases in which when you came up with a particularly useful thing that wasn't patented or couldn't be patented, that the government then looked and said, well, this guy really came up with something useful, and so we're going to reward him. The most famous cases of these was Edward Jenner's invention of smallpox vaccination in 1796, in which the British Parliament voted him, in recognition of his major contribution to the realm, a lump sum of £30,000, which was a very substantial amount at the time. Then there were other private organizations which gave out smaller awards, but very prestigious. This is the Society of Arts, founded in 1754, very much sort of a typical response to the recognition that you want to incentivize people to innovate. There are also a few enterprises in which some entity, often a government or some official entity, but not always, promises a prize to somebody who will solve a well-known problem. Okay, so the most famous of these is the Board of Longitude Prize, which was established in 1714 to the person in Britain, to the person who could solve the problem of longitude at sea, which was one of the great unsolved problems of the 17th and late early 18th century. And below, believe it or not, it was solved. John Harrison came up with his famous marine chronometer in 1750. Well, then, you know, he got some of the money and not all of the money, I don't ask. But the promise was there, and it incentivized him. Maybe a slightly less known case is the prize promised by the Société d'Encouragement pour l'Industrie Nationale, established by... established a prize for somebody who came up with mechanical linen spinning. So spinning at that time was mechanized, but only in cotton and in certain kinds of wool. But linen is a different kind of fiber, and it was hard to do. And so the French promised this huge prize to somebody who came up with it, and it was actually solved by a man called Philippe de Girard, who applied then for the prize. But by the time, you know, it was already, Napoleon was in Russia, and he probably had other things on his mind, so that's probably not, didn't happen. Well, then there are a few other things like reputation effects, you know, and there's some cases in which it's actually, particularly engineering, where you incentivize simply by being famous and getting commissions. But all of those are what I call high-powered incentives. That is to say, you come up with a good idea, you get paid, roughly speaking, in proportion. With propositional knowledge, that is scientific insights, this is much more difficult, of course, because we don't really, actually, it's sort of very hard to measure precisely what the social benefit is, because it doesn't have to undergo a market test, right? It's kind of obvious. There's no easy way of monetizing it. So why do people bother? And so, and what I'm going to argue is that the Western world, because they realized that this kind of knowledge eventually will lead to economic growth, set up a whole set of institutions that provided these incentives. So I'm going to have give you five major categories. Some of them are sort of more obvious than others, maybe, but I think they all played a role. So there are the five categories, and I'll go through them very briefly. So patronage jobs. So the 16th and 17th century were the age in which well-known scientists who made major contributions actually were given patronage job, basically meaning that a king, or in the case of Rudolf II, an emperor, or a pope, or a very wealthy aristocrat would bring somebody to their court and basically say, well, you sit, you eat at my table, and you know, and you can tutor my children, and if you're a doctor, you can take care of my, you know, my sick people, but basically, you are working for me. You can, here is your apartment, and you get dinner and breakfast every day, and you know, that kind of thing. We, of course, have a patronage system today in universities, and we call it tenure. It's patronage because it basically doesn't make you particularly rich, but it provides you with an acceptable income, a high level of security, which will allow you to do your work. We basically, that's what patronage was supposed to do. And so, you know, some famous cases of patronage and many, many non-famous cases that I dug up and put in my book. Here's one example, just for the heck of it, because we're in France after all. This is Descartes. Descartes was living in the Netherlands, as many of you know. But he was already quite famous, one of the more influential philosophers in Europe. And so the Queen of Christina of Sweden was a bit of a dilettante, if I may say that. But she was ambitious, and she wanted to make her court the center of learning. And therefore, she made him an offer. And so he was, as I said, he was already famous, and he was a prize catch. Now, he didn't actually need the money. He was not rich, but you know, secure. But he went because he was flattered and because the royal court came with a high social status and you get to have dinner with the queen and da-da-da-da-da. It was a bad decision because a year later he caught pneumonia in the Stockholm weather and died. But, you know, that's, of course, these things do happen. Now, in addition to patronage, oh, one more famous patronage story, which I always tell, and that's Galileo. So Galileo was a poorly paid professor of mathematics at Padua, and then one day he gets what we call in the academic world an outside offer. And the outside offer was from the Grand Duke of Florence, who offered him something like 5 times his salary, no teaching, and no committee work. Who couldn't beat it? So he lived in Florence for many years, where he was the court philosopher and very much the intellectual center of the court. The other thing is fame, or, you know, things that signal a reputation, maybe. That's the best way of putting it. And so how do you do that? Well, one of the cute inventions in the West, particularly in universities, is named chairs. And so if you look at people, particularly in the US, but everywhere in the world, a lot of professors not only have tenure, they have a named chair. And the first named chair was actually established by Lady Margaret Beaufort, who was the mother of the first Tudor King Henry VII, the father of Henry VIII, who established in 1502 the Lady Margaret Professorship of Divinity. So, oh, this is not quite, you know, mathematics or physics, but it's an idea. And then slowly more and more chairs are coming up in medicine, in law, in Greek philosophy, and this famous chair, this is the Lucasian chair in mathematics, a private chair, by the way, endowed by a man called Lucas. And in 1663, Isaac Newton became the Lucasian professor of mathematics at Cambridge and held it for 33 years until he went on to get another patronage job, which is Master of the Mint in England. Long story. In France, for instance, you know, since we're here, the Collège de France was established in 1530 by François I. And, you know, again, it's membership in a prestigious institution. It doesn't necessarily pay, but it conveys some kind of an honor and a prestige that people feel. And what's important in particular here is that they really started to reward not just learning, rote learning if you want, but actual original research. And you know, it was, I'm not sure that people were maximizing some kind of welfare function, but it said it certainly was thought by the rulers to add to the prestige of the realm, just as, for instance, having the best composer or having somebody like Anthony van Dyck at your or Rubens at your court, that basically meant you were a powerful king because you could attract the best people. So, in, not just in art and in music, but also in science. And some of these people became celebrities. This is, I think, a striking kind of thing. The age produced scientist celebrities, and nobody more than Isaac Newton. And it's kind of ironic because Isaac Newton wrote his great work, the Principia. There were, by the estimates of experts, no more than 100 people in all of Europe who could understand the mathematics of it. But he became a celebrity And when he died in 1727, tens of thousands of people passed by his body at the funeral in Westminster Abbey. And so this is important because it sends a signal. And that young scientists, ambitious scientists, basically feel, I can be like Ike. You know, that, I think, is why these superstars are important. And it's still true in many other areas that superstars are a major signal for young people to try. I mean, think about, say, football or basketball. Now, we have in economics of superstars, and there's a sort of a seminal article written by Sherwin Rosen, by now almost more than a generation ago. It's a brilliant article. And what Sherwin pointed out is that, you know, superstars will particularly arise when, A, the means of disseminating their products is very cheap. And so in science and in philosophy, that's relatively easy because books spread all over Europe. In music, it became more difficult, and it takes a long time until we get these musical superstars, and in painting and so on. But it's still true that throughout this, in this age, we see the ideas of superstars arising. Now, you need some other conditions that are a little bit more technical. You need the production cost to be orthogonal to the size of the market, basically meaning that the bigger the market, you know, you don't run into rising costs. And you need it to be convex in output, essentially meaning that the knowledge of one Galileo is more than twice the contribution of two mediocre scientists. I mean, it's in Sherwin's article, and it's kind of a neat contribution. But the most important thing is that the stuff can spread, so you get a global reputation. So there are a few people in the Middle Ages, but I'm going to leave them out because it's not all that important. But there's a whole bunch of these superstars, and I already mentioned many of these names, of people who were regarded to be superstars. And there's something more important about superstars, not just that they send a signal to other younger people to try to imitate them, but it's also true that these reputations were international. And if you have an international reputation, that means you're basically immune to anything that people will try to do against you if they don't like you because they think of you a heretic. So one example of that, and I could think of many, is Jan Comenius. So Jan Comenius was this Czech intellectual, I would call him. He did many things, but he was a great philosopher of education, the first. And he got into trouble everywhere. He was originally from Moldavia, but he spent time, I think, if I remember correctly, in Stockholm, in Amsterdam, in London, in Leuven, in Italy, and so on. He was even offered, in 1636, the presidency of the University of Harvard, which he very wisely declined. But basically, it protects you against the accusation of heresy, because you say, no, you accuse me, I take my suitcases and I go. And Comenius moved 17 times in his lifetime, and many of the great philosophers and writers of the time actually used this reputation to go somewhere else if their home country became unfriendly. Never forget that Thomas Hobbes wrote Leviathan here in Paris, and that John Locke wrote the essay on toleration in the Netherlands. So, you know, people moved around, and if you were a superstar, there was somebody to help you finding an apartment and offer you a job. And so, as I said, the significance of this is that it created an incentive. And these incentives were ex ante. So a young person might hope to become a superstar. And of course, most of them do good work, maybe excellent work, but don't become a superstar. And when that happens, of course, what you get is you get many disappointed scholars who die without becoming famous, but then work survives and benefits society. And precisely because the market failures lead societies to underproduce enough knowledge because it's under-incentivized, this offsets that a little bit. And I'm not saying we'll overproduce knowledge, but we will underproduce less. That, I think, is important. But even, of course, and this is a famous quote from Adam Smith, There is also, and this is going to come as a shock to you, but many of these intellectuals have egos, and they want to be respected, particularly by their peers. And nobody put this better than Adam Smith in this theory of moral sentiment, which he points out that this is one of the great drivers of people. It isn't just the money. He says, you know, is it to supply the necessities of nature? It is vanity. Well, you know, this is Adam Smith's writing. It's vanity. But it's vanity because people respect them, people listen to them, people take them seriously. And that, of course, is an incentive here. And so people wanted credit. They wanted to be associated with particular insights and particular inventions and discoveries. So this is a famous sort of case that illustrates that. Robert Boyle, famous English scientist, of course, at the time, but he clearly wasn't in it for the money, because he was, I think, the second or the third richest man in England, with a huge family-owned, huge estates. But at some point, he got annoyed that people were using his work. Excuse me. Without attribution, without giving him credit. So he instructed Henry Oldenburg, who was then the Secretary of the Royal Society, to produce a catalog of his writings so that everybody would know that if they cited this particular thing, he, Robert Boyle, was the originator. So an interesting story. There's a nice modern equivalent of that, which has to do, this is in 2003, and this is when the Nobel Prize for Physics, for Medicine, was awarded to for some people who invented MRI. And MRI, and this was well known at the time, had three inventors. Those two, Paul Loderberg and Sir Peter Mansfield, who got the Nobel Prize. And a third guy called Ray Damanian, who had left academe, opened the business, and got filthy rich, you know, basically selling these machines, whereas the other two remained in academe. And so the Nobel Committee, for reasons of their own, decided to give it just to the academics and leave Damanian out. So he took out one page ads in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and everything else, basically saying the Nobel Prize Committee had done him an injustice, that he had deserved. Oh, it's an interesting story. Well, then there's intrinsic motivation, and essentially, I think of this as people doing science for the same reasons that others do crossword puzzles. So here there's really no incentives, just intrinsic drive. There's an issue, a puzzle, and you solve it. And just like a crossword puzzle, if you solve it, you don't get famous for that, or nobody pays you, but people still solve crossword puzzles, and for the same reason they do science. There's not many, but quite a few examples in history of people who basically did science for that particular drive. So, and the driving thing is, of course, curiosity. So you really want to know something. And curiosity has a really interesting history, particularly in the West. So early Christianity actually thought curiosity was a sin. It was a sin because nature was controlled by God, and if you investigated nature, you were encroaching on the realm reserved for God, and that was, you know, disrespectful, blah, blah, blah. So St. Augustine, for instance, and later even Thomas Aquinas warned against curiosity as a sin. But by the time that I'm talking about, ladies and gentlemen, this has changed dramatically. And I think that is in some ways a canary in a coal mine. So this is Francis Bacon, my hero. And here's what he says. You know, he says, this is in The Great Instauration, one of his best books, the inquisition of nature is in that people should not fall into the error of thinking that the inquisition of nature is in any part interdicted or forbidden. And he cites from the book of Proverbs that states that it is the honor of God to conceal a thing and the honor of kings to investigate them. So that's essentially saying, look, God conceals something and we are going to uncover it, and that's just fine. Here's something even more blatant. This is Thomas Hobbes, who lived a generation later, but he says that curiosity is the desire to know the causes of things. And such as in no living creature but man A man is distinguished not only by his reason, but also by his taking away the care of knowing causes, essentially meaning research. Okay? And then he says, it's a lust of the mind that by perseverance of delight in the continual and indefatigable generation of knowledge exceeds the short vehemence of carnal pleasure. I don't know about that. You know, maybe that's just Thomas Hobbes thinking, but the fact that this is clearly no longer sinful. And so there are some examples of this. You know, Henry Cavendish, I think, who is maybe the best example. He was a recluse English aristocrat, and he discovered hydrogen, but he almost didn't publish anything in his lifetime. It was known somehow, but he didn't talk to anybody, and he didn't publish very much, and many of his most important findings were only published many years after he died. So, interesting story. Then there's the question of religion. And I'm not going to talk too much about religion, except that most people tend to believe that religion was a source of resistance and conservatism against science. But that's an oversimplification. For one thing, in the Middle Ages, anybody who did science and anybody who invented something was in some way associated with the church, either a priest or a monk. But even after the Reformation, Catholics set up a whole bunch of institutions that supported science and taught it, like Jesuits, for instance. You think about somebody like Christopher Clavius. So Christopher Clavius was a German mathematician and a Jesuit, who basically gave us what is now known as the Gregorian calendar. It was called Gregorian because the Pope who assigned it was Gregory, but this guy made it, and it's one of those cases in which it really should be the Clavian calendar, but somehow Gregorian stuck. This is another one of my heroes. This is Athanasius Kircher, also a Jesuit, whose his biography, written by a wonderful Stanford historian called Paula Findlay, and this is called Athanasius Kircher, the Last Man Who Knew Everything. And there's some truth to that. He was a polymath of really impressive. So a lot of these good Catholics, and particularly if you think about somebody like the Frenchman Marin Marsan, who was a friar, these people contributed mightily to science. So, I mean, the church plays a somewhat ambiguous role here. Anyway, I'm going to skip some of the slides because the clock is ticking and I'm not getting to, close to the end. But there is, of course, in the end, also altruism. There are some people who do research because they feel that they, that, you know, humanity is facing some kind of a major challenge, and people are suffering and they're trying to solve it. So if in the process they make some money, you know, tant mieux. But it does happen. So you think about particularly those two guys, Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin, you know, who came up with the polio vaccination. And, you know, and I said polio was a major scourge that everybody was really afraid of, and they did away with it. So clearly they made a major contribution to mankind, and that's what they really were all about. So they were recognized eventually, and, you know, Salk was gotten some kind of nation's gratitude, but I think his ex-ante drive was really to try to solve something that people were suffering from. And, you know, there can come other examples. Here's another one, just for the hell of it. This is Humphry Davy, probably the leading scientist in England in the first decades of the 19th century, who invented, he was a scientist, but he also did technology, and he invented this lamp, which is known as the miner's friend, that prevented explosions in coal mines. And he claimed that he did this just because he felt bad for the miners. Also, if you look at this little footnote, you'll see he realized that he really insisted that everybody admit that he was the inventor. All right. So I think for most people who produced useful knowledge, the incentives were mixed, but they were there, and they were created by an Enlightenment ideology and the institutions that it spawned. So I say something briefly about the demand, and then I want to talk about the structure of the market. So what about demand? And so clearly this is an age in which people want innovation. So here is a famous citation from Dr. Johnson. This is 1750, just on the eve of the Industrial Revolution. But already he says, the world is running mad with innovation. And men are to be hanged in a new way. And I know not whether we shall not in time come to be married in a new way. Ha ha, little did he know. And so clearly there is an openness to innovation. And Europeans, I think, become, precisely because they have become more skeptical of conventional, classical knowledge, they want something to fill the gap. And so if Aristotle is wrong, or if Galenus is wrong, or Ptolemy is wrong, what's right? And that, I think, demand is in the air. People want it, and they buy books that proclaim to have come up with new ideas. And so, basically, I think this sentence is right. They lost their trust in the ancient authorities. They're looking for newer and hopefully, more accurate knowledge. So here is one guy who maybe may have been one of the first ones. This is Niccolò Leoncenno, who published his book attacking one of the great figures of classical knowledge, Plinius's Natural History. In 1547, I think, a Frenchman called Pierre de la Ramée, or Petrus Ramus, as he was known, wrote a dissertation entitled On the Many Errors of Aristotle. Now, I think if he'd written that book, that thesis in 1300, he would have been in serious trouble. By 1540s, 1550s, the zeitgeist was starting to change. Also, he actually paid dearly for this because he was actually killed in St. Bartholomew's Night in 1572. But that's a different story. Okay? And so, that the other source, and this is important, ladies and gentlemen, the other source for ideas is because people increasingly believed what I've been saying all along, which new ideas drive economic growth and economic prosperity. And so this is the belief in progress. And if you believe in progress, in the sense that new ideas and new science can make you more productive and can make your production system more rational, you need to talk to scientists. You need to talk to people who know more than you are. And so what we see happening in the 18th century is this, the birth of the technical consultant, not a topic of great interest. And the question, of course, about consultants is always, and this is true just today, you pay a consultant a lot of money, and 50% of what he tells you, you already knew, and the other 50% is wrong. But and that was probably true at this time as well. But all the same, here is one of the first, not the first, but one of the first scientific consultants. This is John Whitehurst. So these are his dates, early stages of the Industrial Revolution. And he advised industrialists, and he advised landowners, and he invited all kind of people who may be trying, who had some kind of problem, water mining, power mining, many other things that he was a so-called expert in. Here's another one a little bit later. This is Davis Gilbert, who not only consulted to industrialists, he also was an advisor to Parliament, and Parliament was dealing with this thing. So many others, but these are the two best-known ones. But it's not so much that they contributed to economic growth, which I really am skeptical of, but it is that it is a symbol, a signal of the belief that knowing more about nature is going to make us more productive and eventually make us richer. That, I think, all right, so that's the source of demand. Now let me say something about the structure of the market, because I talked about supply, I talked about demand, we talk about the structure of the market. And so one of the things that economists have known forever is that markets suffer from what we call transactions cost. And so, it would be nice if we went off, you go out and you buy a pair of shoes, and the only cost that you incur is the price of the shoes. But of course, that's not true. There are transactions costs, right? You have to try them on. You have to find a shoe store. You have to, you know, look for your size. And then, you know, all kinds of things that are costly, either in terms of money or in terms of time. And so transactions costs determine how effective markets are. And sometimes the transactions costs are so high that the whole market can unravel. Now, in the markets for ideas, I've argued many years ago now that the equivalent of transactions costs is what we call access costs. So basically what it means is that you are, if you're sort of vaguely aware that there's some piece of knowledge that you can use for your factory or your firm or for whatever you're doing, there's a cost involved of getting that knowledge. So what does this cost consist of? Well, it consists of how expensive is it to store this knowledge, how skewed is the distribution of this knowledge? So is it only one person who knows it, or are there lots of people who know it? What is the cost of actually finding the knowledge? Is it in a library? Is it in a book? Is it another storage device? Do you have to hire a consultant? And then you have to find it in the right place. So even within the library, you know, you have to find the right book, and then you have to find the right information. And above all, of course, the harder thing is separating fact from fiction and knowledge from fake knowledge, clearly. So why do access costs matter? Well, there's a little table here. I'm not going to get into it too much time for the lack of time. But basically, it's very important that if you engage in either technological research or if you're doing any kind of other research, that you know the literature, right? And so there's all kinds of reasons why you should do this. But this is sort of as obvious. I'm going to skip it. But here's one thing that may not be quite as well known, and I want to dwell on this for a few minutes. And that is that the transaction cost in the market for ideas, to a large extent, depend on trust. Right here. And that is, somebody comes and tries to sell you a piece of knowledge, but you don't really have the capability of assessing it. So can you trust him? And there's a beautiful book here that was published quite a while ago, by Simon Schaefer and Steve Shapin, called Leviathan and the Air Pump, which is about that. And what they basically pointed out, that experimental science, which came into its own in the 17th century, and basically people performed experiments and then reported on the experiments, trying to convince you of certain propositions that the experiment had shown, like the existence of a vacuum or something like that. And so but the person who reads the book or who listens to the lecture is not going to perform the experiment himself. So how do you know that it's true? Well, that's what Shapin and Schaefer call a technology of trust. And that is a critical element in access cost. Okay, so what they point out, and I think there's some truth to that, is that scientific knowledge doesn't become accepted, that is to say, bought in the market for ideas, simply because it's true in some abstract sense, because the buyer has no way of knowing this for sure. The technology of trust is a set of social and material practices that make people believe claims that they cannot personally identify. Okay, so Boyle, who was a major participant in this debate, basically pointed out that what you need is sort of carefully staged public experiments, so at least whoever wanted could come and see it. Detailed written reports. Of course, today, if you write a paper in experimental biology, you start off with methods and materials, which is very much the same thing. You have trustworthy people, or as the British call them, gentlemen, who are regarded as honorable, who testify that the experiment was carried out. Then there are other experimenters who will replicate the experiment. And then, essentially, that there's some kind of consensus emerging in the Republic of Letters that, yes, this experiment is correct, and, in fact, a vacuum pump really creates a vacuum, and on and on. And so we have this still today, you know, somewhat augmented, I would say, with peer review in, you know, refereed journals and quality of the publication channel. You know, is this a good journal? Is this a good publisher? And so on and so forth. But essentially, this technology of trust is still guiding us, perhaps much more than in the past, because nobody you know, why does anybody who's not a physicist believe that quantum theory is right? I mean, we take people's word for it. And so we trust experts. We trust people that we hope can be trusted. And of course, that means that it can be fragile, and often is. So this trust is a convention. And it's often challenged and undermined by experts or by charlatans. And so you think about the current campaign against vaccination in the United States, and it's undermining trust, and it's undermining the technology of trust by people who are charlatans. But, you know, that's a different story. In the late 16th, in the late 15th century, in the 16th century, the two major technological developments that make the reduced access cost. One, of course, is the printing press, which I already mentioned, and the other is the growing effectiveness of the postal system. So people actually corresponded and told each other by letter, I proved this theorem, or I discovered this star, or whatnot. And there were actually people who were known as intelligencers, of whom the most famous are this man, Samuel Hartlib, and your own Marin Marcin, who actually received letters from other scientists and then copied them and sent them to other people who would be interested. So this is a way in which, you know, access becomes more easy. But to my mind, one of the most interesting things about reducing access is what I call the codification project. And so there's a standard distinction in the sort of philosophy of knowledge between what's called a tacit knowledge and codifiable knowledge. So tacit knowledge is things that we know, but we can't write down and we can't quite explain. We just know how to do it, okay? You know, it's like a basketball player shooting a three-pointer. I mean, he knows how to do it, but if you'd ask him, well, will you please exactly explain how to do it? He says, I don't know how I'm doing it, but I can show you. That is what tacit knowledge is all about. Now, artisanal knowledge, so the knowledge of artisans, in the past was largely tacit. You know, there were no books about how to do carpentry or shoemaking or, you know, whatever. And in fact, most of the artisans actually tried to not publicize this too much anyway. So what happens is, from at some point, maybe I would say put it late in the 17th century, but certainly in the 18th century, people started to codify technology. And this was a major project that hasn't actually been given quite the kind of sort of attention that it deserves. Books, of course, mattered. But of course, in books itself, it had to be easily accessible. So books start getting indexes. And books are organized alphabetically. And of course, some of these, if you read in 19th century books, sometimes you look at the table of content, and the table of content isn't just the chapters. Actually, underneath the chapters, it tells you exactly, you know, what's in the chapter, which is kind of a nice search engine if you think about it. I'm not sure, we don't do that anymore because we have indexes, and anyway, most of the books are on PDF, so you just do search that way. But there's a wonderful book by a friend of mine, Daniel Hedrick, called When Knowledge Came of Age, in which points out that one of the things that you see happening in the 18th century, because people wanted to codify knowledge so that it could become more accessible, is encyclopedias and dictionaries. So here is one in England, which is sort of what you'd expect. And this is a book published in 1764, mostly by a guy called Henry Croker. And you can sort of see what's in here. It's sort of an interesting story. So you have anatomy, and you have pharmacy, and you have surgery, and you have mechanics, and hydraulics, and pneumatics. So all these things that are useful to some producers. And, you know, I've spent some time reading it. This isn't for beginners, ladies and gentlemen. There's a fair amount of math in there. There's very detailed illustrations. This is for people who know already something but want to know state-of-the-art knowledge. Okay. Now, the most famous of all these documents, and you don't have to say this in Paris, is, of course, this. I'm not going to talk about it because everybody knows, but it is full, of course, of technical descriptions of any sort of technology that you want with pictures and very careful descriptions. Somewhat less famous, but even more detailed, is this. This is the Description des Arts et Métiers. It was a project that took many decades to put together. It is a long story, and I'm not have time to talk about it. But to give you an example of what this codification looked like, this is this. This is the lockmaker's art. And you can sort of see the fine description. And this is just, you can see each of these figures has a number. And in the text, they explain exactly where it goes and what it does and ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. I don't actually understand all that. And I've read a few of these volumes. And they're not the most, you know, fun reading. But it gives you an idea about what this codification looks like. And here, books are coming out. Mostly, by the way, in French, more so than in English, which is an interesting thing. This is a book written in 1808 by this man called Betancourt, who was actually Spanish, but never mind that. But as you can see, it's an elementary course in machinery. And that one is also written by a Frenchman who spent a lot of time in England studying coal mines. So these are careful descriptions of how these things are being done. And it is codification of knowledge. Now, I may skip this, but I don't want to be accused of Eurocentric tendencies, so I will skip this Chinese stuff, but if anybody wants to ask me about it, I will gladly talk about it. But I want to talk a little bit about the market for knowledge today, because I think that is what I promised you, and I will keep. If I talk about China, I won't keep my promise. In many ways, what we have today on a global level, ladies and gentlemen, is a massively scaled up version of what emerged in Europe in the 16th and 17th century. And scale here is really everything. And many innovations, of course, have come up, not just, of course, the kind of market for ideas that we know today, which is nobody goes to the library anymore because everything appears on the screen and all the journals. You can PDF them, and it's wonderful. But even something much more elementary is an innovation. One of them is what we call the scientific paper. Now, you know, the scientific paper is the fundamental instrument by which economists communicate. Historians will write books, but economists, myself being an exception, mostly write articles and not book. Now, scientific journals had emerged in the 1660s, not that many, but there were some. But the scientific paper, as we know it today, appearing in refereed journals, for the first time appeared in Germany in the Annalen der Physik und Chemie, and then which gradually shifted to the form of scientific papers under the editorship of this man called Poggendorf, who basically created this idea of the scientific paper. But even as late as 1900, some of the most respected journals basically didn't publish papers. They published book reviews and they published brief communications. But if you had a longer thing, you go and write a book or write a monograph. It's kind of striking. By now, of course, the scientific paper has become the fundamental way in which we communicate, and certainly in economics, writing books has become somewhat less central. What about incentives? So all the incentives that I mentioned to you, stimulating science in particular, patent system, is, we all know, is alive and well. But we live in a world of patent. In 2024, 3.7 million patents were filed worldwide. Almost half of them in China, by the way, which is sort of interesting, given that China didn't have a patent system, really, until the Deng Xiaoping reforms. But, you know, the rest of the world is also still filing patents. The US had 600,000 patents, the EU about 200,000. The numbers aren't quite comparable, by the way, so don't push me on the details. But, you know, the numbers are obviously impressive. But what we also do, far more than people in the past, also we learned from them, is these sort of signals of excellence that we give out. And They're still low-powered in the sense that there's not necessarily proportionality between the economic importance and the reward. But we have these institutions by which we recognize people who have made contributions. And so, as I said, created incentives for people who haven't gotten the debt, but who are going to work harder in order to get it. Okay, so some of these were founded, as I say, in the past. The British Royal Society, which I already mentioned, founded in 1660. In the United States, we have the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which was founded in 1780. The NAS, which was founded, doesn't say here, but it was founded in 1863 during the American Civil War. The American Philosophical Society, one of the first one in America, founded by Benjamin Franklin in 1743. The French, of course, the Académie des Sciences, which is founded not many few years after the Royal Society. The Preußische Akademie der Wissenschaften, founded in Berlin in 1700, and on and on. But these organizations were there already in the past. We have founded hundreds of these things. Yes, people are members of all kinds of organizations that convey some kind of prestige. We also have prizes, far, far more than we had before. Of course, at the top of the pyramid is presumably still the Nobel, but there's all these other prizes that people talk about. The Lasker Prize, the Fields Medal in Mathematics. There's no Nobel Prize in Mathematics for reasons we all know. The Balzan Prizes and the Wolf Prize, the Spanish BBVA Frontiers of Knowledge, Spinoza Prizes, and so on and so forth. This is where the 20th century was particularly good. So we learned the idea, and we just blew it open. So even the Nobel Prize started only in 1901. Now, some of these prizes have a fair amount of cash, but that's not what people really want about them, as the example of Ray the Median that I showed earlier really do. In Britain, they came up with a very clever idea, knighting people. So knighting people doesn't pay at all, but people really want it. Now, in the past, again, there are a few examples. Isaac Newton was knighted. So was Humphrey Davy, the inventor of this miner's friend that I mentioned earlier, and Lord Kelvin, the great physicist. But it was rare. And some people actually denied it. Michael Faraday wouldn't have any of it. But then in the 20th century, you can sort of see that this idea sort of comes up in their mind. So these great physicists, J.J. Thompson, Rutherford, Arthur Eddington, all were knighted, some of them winning after the Nobel Prize. But after 1980, this became a deluge. And I'm proud to say that a very close professional friend of Philippe Aguillon and myself is now Sir Timothy Besley. And so even economists have been benefiting from this. And you know, clearly the idea is, you know, we want to incentivize people. And other countries, of course, imitating the West as they do. Japan set up the Japan Prize. China establishes the state preeminent science and technology award in 2000. So they got the idea as well. And of course, some of these are actually run by government. In the United States, this is kind of interesting. We have the National Medal of Science that was established by the president, President Eisenhower in 1959, but they remain at the discretion of the president. And so you may not be shocked that between 2016 and 2022 none were awarded, and I would not bet on any being awarded in the next few years, but who knows. We also have the National Medal of Technology that was established by Jimmy Carter, and also has depended on the particular occupant of the White House. And of course, we still have the economics of the winner-take-all prize. And as I said, it stimulates the work, not just of the people who win, which is kind of obvious, but also of the many more who would hope to win and don't. Now, people, of course, still practice open science. We live in a world, I would say, of open science on steroids. It's true that there are certain areas now where commercial interests clash with open science, and that does create problems. But these are, I think, the exception rather than the rule. It's an interesting, by the way, to note that there is this man, Derek Price, whom actually overlapped with me at Yale, but I never met him, to my great chagrin, who pointed out in 1963 that this plethora of papers was going to come to an end. Okay, so here you have, this is Derek Price, next to the Antikytera mechanism, which he helped invent, and this is his book, published in 1963, Little Science, Big Science, a great classic, I think, in the study of science. And he basically predicted that the number of papers would slow down simply because they couldn't keep going exponentially much faster than population. But he was wrong, at least at the time. In 2023, about 3.3 million scientific papers were published worldwide. And in 2014, it had been 2.2. So there is still growth. And so these various sources talk somewhere around maybe 3 million, depending on what you count as a paper and what not. Now, eventually, this must slow down by the logic of exponential series. But it hasn't happened so far. The market for idea, ladies and gentlemen, is alive and kicking, at least quantitatively. So there's something called which is kind of cute. This is an idea of Derek Price. He pointed out when he wrote this book in 1963, that 80 or up to 90% of all the scientists who were alive, who ever existed in history, were alive at that time. And that sort of shows you the incredible expansion of the market for ideas. It's still true today, I think. Somebody calculated, I saw the number the other day. It's a little bit lower, obviously, because a lot of people have died since 1963. But still true that 70% of all scientists in history are alive today. That's known as the coefficient of immediacy. I don't know where that term comes from, but there you have it. But of course, access costs today are very different. You know, the market for ideas in the 17th century was dependent on a slow and costly postal service. I regret to have to announce that the postal service, at least where I live, is still slow and expensive, but we don't use it. Nobody checks their mailboxes anymore. I mean, in their physical mailbox, you look at your email. Clearly, we are in a very different world as far as the flow of information is concerned, and distance has essentially become a non-factor. So, here's a question. Given the importance of access costs in the market for ideas, will they go to zero with all these new things? First, of course, internet, and then Google, and now AI and ChatGPT or Claude and these other things. And I'm submitting to you that that's not the case. Access costs have changed, but some of the issues in the past that people struggled with, they are still struggling with. And the two big things that I think technology has a hard time solving is selection and verification. So selection is basically because there's so much information we have access to that everybody must choose and select information that she or he looks at, because you can't possibly read everything, nor can you even read the summaries that ChatGPT will create of it, right? I just can't do it. The other thing, of course, is verification, because with the growth of information, there's a huge expansion of fake knowledge. Machines are hallucinating, come up with things that never existing. If you haven't encountered that, you haven't used ChatGPT enough. But it's also true that people deliberately put false information on the internet. What is particularly worrisome, I think, is that modern technology, particularly artificial intelligence, make the distinction between fake and real knowledge really, really hard. And that will, there's a serious danger that the technology of trust that Schaefer and Chapin were talking about may be under serious attack. And that worries me. And that is, of course, compounded by the fact that certain populist regimes, you know, exist because they are attacking elites and they're attacking experts. And so the supply side is thriving, so is the demand. So people want more knowledge. And here is, and I'm almost done, but here's an interesting insight that I encountered a couple of weeks in The Economist. So this is Xu-Wei Fang, who is a professor of, communications at Harvard Business School, but it's worth pointing out what she says because it's directly relevant to the demand side of the market for ideas. Here's what she says. AI doesn't only create machine demand, it simultaneously expands human demand as well. The obscure corners of information demand, very specific needs that no article or broadcast could ever serve before, become addressable. Conversational AI brings latent demand for ideas to the surface too, helping people articulate needs they couldn't previously express. Tack, 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 tack. In other words, it's the new technology actually creates itself new demand. In economics, of course, that's in supply and demand, that's a problem. But in the market for ideas, as I think I've been trying to convince you, a lot of things happen that don't happen in other markets. And that, therefore, will remain another story. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.